We're not going to let both barrels fire at once. Paddy's going to go first and Stan's going to go second. They're both tackling the same subject, along dear to Morris's heart, not dear to every socialist's heart by any means. This is somewhat contentious for socialists. Some people don't believe you should really go into this in too deep, greater detail. However, there are different ways of tackling and of thinking about from here to there. That's the title. From where we are to where we want to get to. And so I'll ask you to now listen to Paddy Shannon to open up. I don't know whether you've got a particular subtitle to yours, Paddy.
I have.
Yeah, right. You'll tell them that then.
I will. Just before I do, can I just do a quick plug for some stickers that we're producing. Like I said, I'll leave them here. Somebody have a look at them. If you want some, let us know. I'll send them. I've got a t-shirt there if you want one of those. They're probably about a fiver. So let me know about that as well. Okay. Now, as to the talk, I'll move on swiftly. Now, as you know, we socialists generally look upon writing blueprints as a terrible idea. And the following blueprint is going to prove once and for all why it's a terrible idea. It's a short story, so it's a bit different from your average talk. It's based on news from nowhere, about as closely as James Bond films are based on the books, or drum and bass is based on music. It flagrantly disregards any possible hint of caution, scientific scepticism, or even taste. So I hope you'll find it entertaining. If you don't, at least it's not too long. Stands on hand to bring it down to earth a bit afterwards. So, please indulge me then in a little pocket version of News From Nowhere, soon to be updated with slightly over-the-horizon technology and some over-the-hill jokes. It's called Late News Extra From Nowhere. I woke up this morning in a groggy state after last night's party meeting piss up. The beer and the optimism had worn off. The day ahead seemed about as attractive as a Daily Mail editorial. God, it was hot for some reason. Maybe I left the heating on. I think I thought about the bills and got depressed. Capitalism, I said to myself. Work, I said, managing a snarl. I was in a Bob Black mood today. Fuck it, I think I'll go for a swim. Not in my local river, naturally, although you might skate on the slime. I meant the local baths. And when I went outside to the riverbank to let the fog clear out of my head, I saw something that brought the fog straight back again and made me think my comrades had been spiking their drinks. A salmon had just leapt out of the water. Splash, it went. I rubbed my eyes. Hey, you scared the life out of me. Where did you spring from? I whirled, disoriented. She was the tallest woman I'd ever seen, and the only things she had on were a tattoo, some bangles, and a puzzled expression. I said, well, normally I'm more articulate than that, but I was having trouble breathing by this time. I needed to get back into bed and start again. Have you been sleeping in these old ruins? What's the matter? Company not good enough for you or what? She gestured vaguely at what I thought was my house, but seems to have deteriorated in the night. I can't think how a roof and two walls could have fallen in without me noticing. The woman stood, arms akimbo, in her glory, considering me. I've got a boat here. I think you'd better come with me. Rah. She took me by the arm in a polite but firm grip, and I didn't argue. Down we went to the waterfront and climbed in what looked like a cross between a rowing boat and a Fabergé chandelier. I gawped. The entire thing seemed to be made out of what I took to be solar panels, but which looked more like pure diamond. It was the Bank of England in a boat. I was so amazed, I scarcely even noticed it start. And as it cut noiselessly through the water, I only faintly registered that the water was clean and sparkling. I looked about me. Leaves were on the trees. It was hot. This wasn't the winter's morning I was expecting. I was about to try to speak when we came to a bridge, and I nearly fainted. The thickest part of it was no bigger than my wrist, yet there was a stream of heavy traffic going across it. My brain somersaulted and sat down on its bun to cry. My mouth hung slackly, moaning involuntarily. All this time, the woman's eyes never left me. I know you. Your name's Billy Guest. You're 38, and you live at that house I saw you in front of. Am I right? I stared at her while my brain begged for mercy. How, I attempted pathetically. My name's Ellen. I've been doing some checking. You're a floater. We get them sometimes. We're not sure why. It might be a side effect of our wormhole experiments. Do you know what year this is, Billy? No, of course you don't. How stupid. Well, prepare yourself for a shock. It was a shock. Another one. You can only take so much before breakfast. I passed out. They were pouring something down my throat when I came to. I struggled, and hands held my head and stroked my hair. There was a sweet smell. I felt sick. It's all right, Billy. Nobody's going to hurt you. Don't worry. You're quite safe. I was in some kind of laboratory, and there were wires all over me. That's it. The aliens have got me. Now for the experiments. Wow, what are you doing? What are you doing? Leave me alone. I could hear myself yelling all over the place, trying to pull the wires off, when a young voice spoke in my ear in a rather impatient tone. Hey, dude, relax, or you'll screw up your own prophylaxis. You don't want some disease and die, do you? I turned. The voice belonged to a boy of about 13. He was wearing the wildest set of golden ultraviolet duds I ever saw, which kept shimmering up and down like a TV on the blink. Only I wasn't looking at the clothes, but at the hypodermic he was wielding in one hand. I gargled with terror and cast about me wildly, looking for an exit. Then I saw the woman from the boat, Ellen. She was looking annoyed and said, "Hey, Boffin, take it easy. Can't you see he's in shock? You're trying to scare him to death." She came over to me and put a hand on my arm. Instantly, a flood of well-being coursed through my system like the third pint after a spell of overtime. I relaxed. She talked. I relaxed more. I let the kid do the thing with the hypo and didn't even feel it. I was calm and confused, and all the while she talked to me in low, urgent tones, I was thinking, how come you create a float? You're a floater, Billy. Nobody knows how it happens, but it's happened before. You just floated out of your own time and landed here. But you're going to have to get used to it, I'm afraid, because there's no going back. So if you don't like it, well, tough cheese. But we think you will, especially considering where you've been. So just listen. Our records have got you down as a socialist. That's good, because it means we don't have to explain non-market democracy to you. We had an anarcho-capitalist with a floater once. That was bad. He spent the first 5 years in denial. Okay, things you should know. We have electropathic access to global population records going back to 1850. Any floater we get from before then, we're just guessing about. But we've got the file on you, courtesy of your nice police system, and your medical records. You had asthma and bronchitis, we fixed that for you. And you had an incipient tumour, so we fixed that too. Anything else you want us to do to your body, you'll have to ask, because we don't like to assume. You should get a good 300 years out of it before anything else needs fixing. Say, Billy, don't look so shocked. You won't get bored, I promise you. Lesson one, don't get stressed about anything. There's no need, and there's plenty of time. As far as you're concerned, you're on permanent holiday. Let's see, culture, mixed bag. We like variety, even in our seasons. That's why we don't bother too much with climate control domes. We go mostly naked in summer, but for parties in winter, we like to dress up nice. And for you, since you're new around here. If you fancy sex, just say so, but don't lay an emotional trip on anyone, or you'll be going to bed lonely. Politics, you decide. Opt in, opt out. Just don't complain if you don't like the results. Sports, well, people still like tennis and football. Can't imagine why. What is it? That boat. That diamond boat. Oh, that. A sunboat. Diamondoid solar collectors, pretty standard. So I was right, but diamondoid? I had another question. That bridge, the one over the river, what was that made of? She shrugged. Carbon bucky tubes, 100 times stronger than steel, 1/4 the weight. Invented about your own time, didn't you read about it? Anyway, that's nothing, you should see our space stations. Now, where was I? Education, your own, however you want it. You'll be giving some too. People are going to be asking you a lot of questions, I warn you. Bob here is fascinated. Capitalism, you know. Nobody can figure it out. I don't know what they put in me, but I was feeling quite my old argumentative self by now. So I responded forthrightly enough. Well, it was a commodity-sized society based on production for sale on a market, and no. I mean, nobody can figure out why you poor slobs put up with it for so long. But never mind, that'll keep. Are you hungry? I thought about this. Most of my life I've been professionally not hungry, because food involves buying without money and cooking without skill and eating without pleasure. But I nodded anyway. Never pass up a free lunch, I thought, even in a common ownership world. The kid Boffin instantly got up and went to a cavity in the wall. What do you want, Billy? I had a feeling that whatever I said would come out of that hole in the wall as a white paste on a cream cracker. So I said, just to be awkward. Roast duck in black bean sauce on a bed of couscous with pineapple rings and sour cream. And a whiskey. fucking scratched his head. Are you kidding me? We don't have a program for that. You want me to go find a chef or something? Alan said, give him some donuts and coffee for now. His file says he's a vegetarian anyway. But this boffin laughed and pressed some buttons. As I watched, a plate of donuts actually grew in the cavity in front of my eyes. Boffin brought them over with the coffee. You don't need to bother being a vegetarian anymore, Billy boy. Our meat products never cluck or go bad to begin with. I fingered the donuts dubiously, turning them over in my hand. They looked real enough, right down to the sugar. I looked up to see Ellen regarding me curiously. They won't kill you, you know. It's just nanotech programming. We can do most things, but if you've got a preference we don't have, well, there's plenty of people who like doing the real thing, cooking, you know. They tasted like, well, donuts. Finally, I said, look, you give me a book, or show me a film, or do something. I'm feeling seriously out of my depth. What's nanotech? The boy and the woman looked at each other silently. Then Ellen nodded and turned to me. Okay, we'll give it to you the easy way, all at once. How's that? Boffin thinks you can handle it, and so do I. All you need is a little shot in the arm. Yes, I know, another one. And then you'll sleep for a half hour or so, and you'll be in the picture. Here, hold your arm out like this. The kid jammed in a huge hypo, but the needle was so thin I couldn't even see it, much less feel it. Almost immediately I felt tired. That's the pre-anesthetic kicking in. Just lie down and take it easy. Let the box get to work. I shut my eyes then, and when I shut them, a whole new world opened up for me. They had reforested most of the earth. Village life was the norm, although cities still existed mainly as leisure centres, and lifestyles were pleasantly rural. Most people engaged in some form of handicraft or creative arts. Nobody knew less than around 30 skills, but they had a long time to learn them. The world buzzed with living music and spontaneous street corner festivals. But though the modus vivendi seemed engagingly rustic, behind the simplicity lay a staggering array of invisible technology, molecular nanotechnology to be exact. Almost all materials were nano-engineered in some way, either to be brawny or brainy. The new class of molecular-bonded fullerenes, like the Bucky Tube, revolutionized transport and habitation with super-strong materials that couldn't break or wear out. Other materials were smart as well. There was a supercomputer in every drop, spit, and millimeter of fabric, metal, wood, paint, glass, and liquid. Some of these could change into each other. In some workplaces, and all theatres, even the atmosphere itself was charged with a kinetic nano-gas called utility fog, which by changing its molecular form on command allowed one to move large heavy loads with a wave of the hand, or create and dissolve any object at will. Houses, trains, planes, clothes, nothing was manufactured. All was grown in vats with no noise, no waste, and virtually no energy requirement. Food could be grown naturally, or quickly nano-processed out of carbon dioxide and hydrogen, or even old waste or pollutants. Villagers wore mood-responsive clothing with optional micro-armor to guard against accidents and injury. They talked loudly, used to having space around them, or conferred silently in electropathic communication with friends across the village and across the world. They had indefinite lifespans and unlimited disease immunity. They walked on roads with molecular diamondoid layering, which provided the world's solar energy requirements and had rendered fossil fuels obsolete. They hitched rides on superconductor buses and trains, which could be pushed along by a little finger. And, oh joy, they argued about absolutely everything. It was gratifying to see that the best things in life don't change. The big change, the one that replaced world capitalism with the world share ethic, had come about, contrary to everybody's expectations, rather peacefully. It was the bio and nanotech revolutions which were largely responsible. Unable to prevent it, the old authoritarian governments could only watch as the awesome abundance of these new technologies steadily undermined the entire structure of markets and money. Things just got cheaper and cheaper, until common sense said that everything might as well be free. There just didn't seem any point in capitalist buying and selling anymore, and no amount of state propaganda could pretend there was. The hot countries went first. The cold northern countries, possibly because of their Calvinist roots, seemed determined to remain masochistic to the last, but they folded eventually. Instead of class war, it was a general strike. Instead of violence, unaggressive non-cooperation. Instead of mobilized vanguards and Bolshevik takeovers, it was a more generalized kiss up in the brewery, followed by a universal inclination to spend the day in bed. Nobody, no revolutionary theorist, had ever theorized this. Such was the lesson of history. You just never bloody well know. But nobody was complaining about it. TV had died out through lack of interest, although funnily enough, people liked the old commercials so much that they created new ones, now called Hypercube, in which the object was to change the viewer's opinion about a matter of no importance as artistically as possible in exactly 30 seconds. This became an extremely popular form of shorthand art, and the best ones became world famous. In the main, art came back to the village. Visitors could count on surprise after surprise as the locals revealed their cultural secrets. And a common ambition amongst the young was to visit every village on earth. Many villages became renowned because of these travellers' tales, but protocol demanded that visits were granted before arrival, so people never became swamped. In general, the young, that is, under 200, were air types, a style of life owing everything to the Bucky Tube jets, which were so light they even had their own parachutes, and could travel immense distances with the new high-performance fuel compounds. The air types, like travelling youth hostelers in days of yore, did the routine, low-concentration tasks the Earth types found tedious. When they tired of cloud-hopping, people became Earth types who preferred to settle. Among these, necessary work was scant, but displayed on rosters and oversubscribed. Unnecessary work was, conversely, abundant, because people made it up. On every street there were self-appointed researchers, designers, practitioners, and students, all beavering away and burning midnight oil, red-rimmed and triumphant. Some of this effort was rather silly, but some of it led to breakthroughs. Through every village and every mountain range and across every sea, the planet had become a virtual powerhouse of ingenuity. The space program was well advanced, with nano drones powered by a terrestrial microwave able to travel at half light speed to the nearest star systems. Mars had been roughly terraformed, and the moon converted to warehousing and some research facilities. With the final mapping of the entire Gaia macro genome, evolution could be gently and subtly directed, if need be, although such action was rare and subject to global consensus. Most importantly, advances in geology provided reasonable evidence that the Earth had only 1,000 or so years left before the next great supervolcano. And thus, the macro genome could be used to entirely kit out a barren planet in Earth's beautiful livery, ready for the day when there was nothing but lava in the old backyard. Humans were cooperating in the greatest race they could run, the quest for their own survival. And they seemed, on the whole, to be winning. I woke up feeling like a Durham miner on Morecambe Beach in August. This is the life for me. I could have had an ice cream from that ludicrous hole in the wall. I dare say they could have made it produce beer fags and chips too. But as I opened my eyes, I saw Ellen again, grinning at me, and an entirely different pool came to my mind. Is that all true? I mean, is it? Ellen grinned wider. No, we just made it up for a joke. It's really hell out there. This time I was grinning too. And how about the sex part? Ellen looked sidelong at me. Billy, me boy, whenever you like, since you're cute. But you are just a kid, you know, and I'm over 90. Don't worry, Grant, says I, sitting up slowly. I'll try to jump.
Now, with your indulgence, we won't take questions or discussion, because I think both... I think you'll swap sides if you would, because this is in the way. because I don't think we'll get both contributions in, and I think that's the most important part, and we can do something about it afterwards if we've got time. So without more ado, I'll call on Stan to also talk to the same topic from here to there.
But what can I say? And now for something completely different. It's really mind-boggling. I mean, actually, Paddy did warn me that he was going to do this kind of adventure. I'm coming right down to earth and just going to talk a little about various parts of Morris's idea of the future. And firstly, I want to pick out some of Morris's most notable ideas, ideas which I find generally congenial and much more attractive than most others that have been put forward in the name of socialism, and not incidentally more attractive than what Paddy has just told me. I'm speaking of previous attempts to forecast future socialist society. Now, if my first concern is with the socialist destination, which it is, then my second is the journey to it. What Morris called how the change came. Morris was clearly influenced by recent events when he wrote about the bloody revolution, which would precede socialism. If he were writing today, I think he would be predicting a much different journey. And thirdly, there's the departure point of the journey toward the destination. And that departure point is capitalism today. What socialists have to do is to educate ourselves and others for the momentous journey out of capitalism and toward socialism. Right, first destination. Of course, it won't be a fixed and final destination. Human society, at least since the breakdown of primitive communism and the advent of class society, is essentially in process of change, sometimes very slowly, and other times quite rapidly. In Nowhere, Morris wrote of a period of socialism some 200 years after it had been introduced. He was looking at a period of relative social stability after a period of transition, which I'll deal with in section two, part of the journey. We may divide the stable socialist future, well, I should relativize it, into three aspects. How society will be organized, how we should think and behave as individuals, and how we should treat each other. Morris had a good deal to say about all three, but I think his best descriptions were reserved for how we should treat each other. Socialists today talk and write much about common ownership, democratic control, free access, and so on. Morris put such concepts into more human terms. How incongruous it would be to offer coins to someone who does us a service. How undesirable to want to have punishment and criminal law instead of encouraging remorse for anti-social action. And also incongruous to worry about a few obstinate refusers who want to do their own thing. Marx, I think, was right to insist that with socialism, we should stop being alienated from society and from each other, and stop treating each other as commodities. Morris provided some splendid examples of how we shall treat each other when our social structure facilitates cooperation and trust instead of competition and mistrust. As a young socialist some 50 years ago, I was much influenced by the writings of both Marx and Morris as filtered through the socialist part. In William Cameron's The Day Is Coming, a character says, quote, "If the late Dr. Marx can be said to have given us the bones of socialism, our comrade Morris may be said to have given it flesh, blood, and a soul." You may not like the last word, but I don't mind it. The socialist future painted by Morris has a rural rather than an urban flavour. Interesting too that Paddy sees an urban phenomenon, I think, a rural phenomenon in the future. though Morris does make a point of minimising the differences between city and country life. The theme of work is central to Morris's conception of socialism. In Use and Nowhere, the guest asks Old Hammond, how you get people to work when there is no reward for their labour? The reply is that work has become, quote, a pleasure which we are afraid of losing, not a pain. Old Hammond goes on to explain, quote, all work is now pleasurable, either because of the hope of gain in honour and wealth with which the work is done, which causes pleasurable excitement, even when the actual work is not pleasant, or else because it has grown into a pleasurable habit, as in the case of what you might call mechanical work. And lastly, most of our work is of this kind because there is conscious, sensuous pleasure in the work itself. It is done, that is, by artists. Note that Morris wasn't opposed to the use of machinery. In his pamphlet, Art and Production, he says that, quote, we would do some things by machinery that we know that are now done by hand, and many other things by hand that are now done by machinery. In short, we would be the masters of our machines and not their slaves, as we are now. Of course, it may be argued that we are really the slaves of the system, not of the machinery we use, either compulsorily in our employment or voluntarily in our leisure. It is, I think, interesting to speculate about what place, if any, Morris would have seen for 21st century new technology in socialism if we were writing today. What would he make of humans being able to communicate instantaneously over vast distances? Of the construction of virtual places, people and communities, online shopping, voting by computer, and certainly a lot of what Paddy was saying, what would he have made of these, even just ideas of what the future could take? The men and women in Use from Nowhere have given up being exploited for the sake of someone else's profit. They don't engage in the useless toil required to keep capitalism going. Let's imagine that they do have the opportunity to use electronic gadgetry, perhaps far in advance of what we do have today, such as Paddy's sketch, to virtually interact with anyone, anywhere, to access all information held in all of the world's integrated data banks. To what extent will they take advantage of such opportunities? Now, I think the answer will be that some people will and some won't. Socialism will have its technophiles and technophobes, with some people in the middle, maybe many people in the middle, just as capitalism does. Morris recognised that people like to do different kinds of work and get different kinds of satisfaction from the work they do. He also wrote in praise of the simple life. Quote, we have simplified our lives a great deal from what they were and have got rid of many conventionalities and many sham wants which used to give our forefathers much trouble. We can all agree that technology will no longer be used for capitalist purposes. No sophisticated weapons of war. No convoluted calculations of profit, no highly competitive selection processes for paid employment, no communication purely for and travel for purely business purposes. But we can all have different views on how far and in what ways we use different levels and types of technology for education and leisure, for art and culture. We're doing the kind of work that needs doing and that we enjoy. Descendants of people like me will be happy with the simple life, perhaps sprinkled with a few complications. Almost everything actual and almost nothing virtual. You notice I said almost because I'm wanting to hedge my bets a little here because I do find some of Penny's features quite attractive. No personal, for me, no personal computer, no mobile video phone, plenty of recyclable printed matter and personal content. Descendants of today's socialist technophiles will, I think, be in the forefront of developing who knows what technological marvels, and good luck to them. Okay, second, journey, the journey. How we get a period of economic crisis, unemployment, and social distress would lead to mass demonstration. In 1952, a two-year period of civil war would lead first to conciliation by the government and then repression. The organized workers form a committee of public safety and call a general strike. They increase their strength to form a nationwide network of workmen's associations dedicated to the realization of communism. With the economy coming increasingly under the control of the workers, the capitalist class seeks to crush the socialist opposition once and for all. But the power, the mass power of the workers, proves too strong and the revolution triumphs. It's not unreasonable to applaud Marx for his insight into the nature of revolutions which had yet to take place when he was writing. But whatever the merits are of Morris's account of, in his chapter, quite a long chapter, how the change came, whatever merits may have had at the time he wrote, today I think it's a totally unbelievable account of how the socialist revolution will come. Morris was no supporter of vanguardism, of an educated minority leading the mass of relatively uneducated workers to socialism. He agreed with Marx that there could be no socialist revolution until a majority of people understood and wanted it. Yet, in News from Nowhere, he made no attempt to show what would happen to transform the tiny minority of socialists into a majority of the population. Instead, we're told about mass demonstrations, a civil war, committee of public safety, general strike, pitch battle, which the workers win. Now, I guess that some party members today believe that when the numbers of socialists get big enough to seriously challenge the capitalist system, then the ruling class will organize physical repression of the socialist movement. In other words, those members believe that something not too dissimilar from what Morris foresees will take place. I reject that view completely. I have much more sympathy with the view that as the socialist movement grows, the supporters of capitalism, and we must remember that they are not all necessarily capitalists, indeed they are a minority of capitalists who support capitalism, workers do, that these supporters of capitalism will make increasing concessions to the socialist movement in the shape of reforms of capitalism. But that still dodges the question of what will make the socialist movement grow. I think there are two key words in the answer to the question: education and imagination. Morris had plenty of imagination about the destination, right? But I think he had very little imagination about the journey. I'm tempted to say he had the wrong kind of imagination. He paid too little attention to the role of education in changing society. Today, with only a few hundred socialists in this country and perhaps a similar number in the rest of the world, we can only struggle to maintain the strength of the movement. We're too weak to make much progress towards the destination. What will happen to change things in the direction we want? In the short run, the answer is more active socialists to help make more socialists. Or, and I know one member doesn't like the idea of making socialists, if you don't like that idea that socialists are made, then collect. That we will need to collect more socialists. Right, the point of departure now, which I think is the last part of what I want to say. I've discussed the journey, and I want now to... So the destination and the journey. And I want now to say a few things about the point of departure, where we are today. It's often said that we are going through a difficult period for the socialist movement. Despite capitalism's problems getting more rather than less severe, the idea of abolishing the profit system, replacing it with socialism, I think is arguably weaker now than it was when I first joined the party 50 years ago. I think we have to recognize that in contemporary capitalism, we're up against an immensely influential and deep-rooted system. When Morris was writing, it would have been reasonable to claim that the profit system was supported mainly by those he was fond of calling the profit grinders. Today, it is an unfortunate fact that capitalism is supported not just by the small minority of capitalists, but also by the majority of workers who actively, and even sometimes enthusiastically, cooperate in their own exploitation. I just want to illustrate, there's a book called The McDonaldization of Society, and he looks at the way in which McDonald's have spread the tentacles all over the world as a critic. But he has to admit that most of the people who go into McDonald's actually support the idea. They love their McDonald's. Now, they do so because capitalism isn't just something they vote for every few years. Capitalism is something that permeates every aspect of their lives and ours. We are born into the profit system, educated by the profit system, socialized into the profit system. Our media of information and communication, our leisure, our art, our culture are all soaked in the profit system. The Socialist Party now spends a few £1,000 a year on advertising. We get a welcome trickle of inquiries from the best value adverts, and we wonder why we don't get more. We don't get more because the profit system is promoted, sometimes explicitly, but more often implicitly, by countless billions of pounds spent on the media, which say, in effect, don't think of changing the system. Don't even think there's a system. Live in the real world. You're crazy or stupid if you don't. Some of you will remember that a few years ago here, I floated the idea that what we need are proximate goals, things that we could achieve that will help us on the road to socialism. I suggested a socialist publishing house, a network of socialist education bodies, and a small number of socialist communities. The first two ideas were well received, but the socialist communities were generally rejected. I remember Alan quite strongly, generally rejected if not ridiculed. I'm quite happy to accept that the publishing and the educational ideas are likely to be achieved before the small communities. I haven't given up on that, but I mean by this, socialists living and working together on a relatively self-sustaining basis and treating each other like people treat each other in use and nowhere. Okay, to round off my contribution, I'd like to reiterate my enthusiasm, which has lasted over 50 years, for Morris's imaginative and inspiring picture of our destination. The kindest thing I can say about his account of how the change came is that he was a creature of his time. It is a sobering thought that we are also creatures of our time. Morris's dream of a socialist future is, I suggest, shared to a greater or less extent by all in this room. We may say, as he did, that, quote, if others can see it as I have seen it, then it may be called a vision rather than a dream.